And we're back with the Gestalt Performance Podcast. So we took a little break there. Plan on this podcast to be released maybe every couple weeks throughout the summer months. And then we'll take another little break and then get ramping back up in the fall to prepare for World Pitching Congress 2021. In this interview, we talk with the head of sports performance for the St. Louis Blues, Eric Renahan. Eric has been with the Blues for four seasons now. He was part of the 2019 Stanley Cup Championship team. The dude's name is forever enshrined on the rings of the Stanley Cup. In this interview, Eric and I discuss the approach the Blues take with using data, how they guide their training, and how he uses force plate technology to implement all parts of player performance. So let's get to it and hear more from Eric Renahan. So Eric, good to see you.
Hey Tyler, good to be here.
I just want to do a quick kind of timestamp. It's March 20th, 2020, and we're in the middle of a worldwide pandemic of the COVID-19 coronavirus. And it's a very unusual time. The state of Illinois, where I live, just announced that we're kind of on lockdown for the next couple weeks. All sports are pretty much suspended for the time being, and no one's really sure what's going on. It's a very surreal time. So, like, I wanted to make sure that that's kind of known in this conversation, because you know someone might listen to it a year from now or 2 years from now. It totally changes the context of the conversation potentially, when you hear it kind of either from hindsight or just understanding what's going on. So I wanted to get that out of the way. You and your family are safe, right? You guys are doing good?
Yep. Yeah. I'm coming to you from my basement here, but we are safe. It certainly broadens your perspective on life and what's important. So I think this is definitely a unique time to be chatting with you. And I think people are really worried about what's going to happen in the future. And you know, so I think it's continue trying to educate people and continue getting better at what we do and helping others. So this is an opportunity that I've been looking forward to. So I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. We're cutting up there a tiny bit. I think it'll probably be okay. If it gets too bad, I'll stop you and just have you repeat whatever you said, if that's okay.
Okay.
So, in your intro, basically just, informed everyone, work with the Blues head of sports performance, which essentially you're the strength and conditioning, head of strength and conditioning / head of, movement preparedness / kind of like an overall liaison of everything involved in performance for the team, correct?
Yeah, I guess the title is really kind of doesn't give you as much insights into what I'm doing. Unfortunately, I don't have a staff here, so I'm not really the head of anything other than, my daily operations. So I guess I'm the only, to simply put, I'm the only guy. But yeah, you're right. I oversee strength and conditioning, end stage return to play, sports science, all the nutrition, and generally kind of a helping hand to the other departments as well. We have a partner of what we call a training staff in hockey. And, you're always trying to help out as much as you can with the other guys as well. So, it's more of a team effort. But yeah, for me, generally, I'm overseeing all of those aspects of the performance of our athletes.
How'd you get started with all that? Like, what got you going in hockey and got you to the point where you are now with the Blues?
Yeah, I started off really, I'm from California, so I grew up in California playing, what you might think is a traditional California based group of sports. I played soccer, baseball, did a lot of skiing, went to the beach a lot. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to play soccer in college. And, you know, probably where I should have been focused on getting better at soccer, my time was spent in the gym. And really, you know, I was enamored by strength and conditioning and performance and how I can, you know, just get stronger. And so, after I graduated, an opportunity came up where I was able to get a job and work with athletes at a local university in the Bay Area where I grew up. You know, there's several NCAA Division I universities, several professional sports teams, and ton of club sports teams. And so the ability to network was huge. And so I met Mike Potenza, and Mike Potenza is the head strength and conditioning coach of the San Jose Sharks, and we stayed in touch. When you know, after, in 2011, he chatted with me and said he got an offer to hire an assistant strength and conditioning coach that he'd been trying to get a position for, and asked if I had any interest in that, and I certainly did. So took him up on the offer to join him and his staff there in San Jose, and that's that was my first exposure to hockey, or structured hockey, I guess. And ever since then, last 10 years, I've been in the NHL working. This is my third team, but you know, my exposure to the NHL was right away. You know, during the summer development camp and the off-season programming that Mike was running with guys in San Jose. So that was certainly, you know, getting thrown into the fire right away. It was, you know, you really had to learn quickly how to operate. So it was a unique experience that I think really shaped how I operate now.
So you said three teams. What are those three teams you've worked with? And then how has each team been different as far as like work environment, as far as you know what you're allotted, what you're allowed to do? I know the NHL is different than baseball, where resources are vastly different. What was the difference between each one?
Yeah, so I started with the Sharks. I was Mike, and I was his assistant. We had two summer interns who were great, who are now both working in professional hockey as well. I started there, worked with Mike for, I started my third season when I was offered a position with the Vancouver Canucks. The position that I was offered was an assistant strength and conditioning coach position, same that I had in San Jose. But the goal for them was for Roger Takahashi, who was the head strength and conditioning coach, to move into a high performance director's role from the head strength coach position, and I would move up into the head strength and conditioning coach role. After that first season there, there was a shift in management. The structure stayed the same, and what ended up happening was I stayed on as Roger's assistant. And you know, entered in. I was entering in my fourth season there in Vancouver when the job opening with the Blues popped up, and put my name in for that. Had an interview with Marty Brodeur and Al MacInnis, and next day they offered me the role here in St. Louis, and I'm on my fourth season here in St. Louis. So those are my three teams that I've been with. I guess, like you said, with resources out and the allocation of personnel and what we're able to do in the different teams certainly is unique. I think going through these different teams and getting to where we're at today, you know, there's certainly experiences that when you're in them don't may not seem ideal, but provide a lot of opportunity to learn. And I'd say when I was with the Sharks, it was really about learning the culture of hockey. The team was very successful the year before I arrived. They were very heavy with a veteran presence, and Mike was very established with how he operated there. So it was really a great opportunity for me to learn how to be a strength coach at the professional level. My experiences prior to that were either private sector or collegiate. So really understanding the dichotomy between working with professional level athletes and amateur slash collegiate level athletes. So when I moved into the Vancouver Canucks system, what they had been doing, again, they were very successful as well. They had played in the Stanley Cup final, maybe I think a year or two before I arrived. What they had were resources and the ability to utilize those resources. So Roger Takahashi, who is still the head strength and conditioning coach there, really embraced technology, had a great training culture and a great way of communicating to the athletes on the whys behind the programming and the use of technology. And so my exposure really to technology was intensified in that scenario. And the thing that Raj told me on my first day was he brought me here to run my program and make these athletes better, not to do what he tells me to do. So it was really an opportunity to become, independent, so to speak, and really bring some of my experiences of training athletes and the things that I learned with Mike and blend that into what Roger was doing there. So it was a huge opportunity to, really embrace technology and utilize it on a daily basis. So when I got to St. Louis, I really wanted to establish a training culture that utilized both technology and some of the things that Nelson had been doing prior to my arrival. So when I arrived, I came, my first day here was on development, our first day of development camp, and I really had to establish the way we were going to operate. So it was a unique experience coming in to Ocean Beach. And, from that first day on, it was really about figuring out what we needed to do to build the program to sustain the levels of success that they had had in the past. And what I wanted to do was really try to bring that technology component to what they were doing here in St. Louis. And, we're in year four now. I'm in year four. So I feel pretty comfortable with what we're doing. We've had some success. And I think we have a pretty good model for sustaining that level of success. It's certainly been a buildup of those experiences that has helped shape where we're at today.
Yeah. And let's talk about that a little bit. You guys won the Stanley Cup last year, first time in Blues history, and your freaking name is on the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, that's pretty surreal. I think that's an experience that I'll never forget. And, those are when you go through some of these experiences and you work with great mentors like Mike and Raj, and you have the opportunity to win something like this, you really value even more of those experiences that these guys have provided to me. It's not easy to win. It's certainly a coveted opportunity, and the opportunities that Mike and Roger have given to me really make you even more appreciative of those opportunities. So it's certainly been an honor.
So I remember a previous conversation we had, you were telling me a story a little bit about during the Stanley Cup where you guys had to either fly back to St. Louis like that night or wait the next day. And you were basing it off of some sleep research and some like time zone change research to best benefit the recovery for the Blues. Go ahead and tell us that story a little bit.
Yeah. So we were in the conference finals. We were here in St. Louis playing San Jose, and it was a Thursday. I think it was game four. And, we ended up winning that game. And San Jose flew back after that game to San Jose. Our team wanted to fly back right away as well. And I really made us, I guess, a concerted effort to convince our head coach and our general manager to stay in St. Louis until Friday evening and get to San Jose Friday night. really more for our circadian rhythms, but I guess even more so for the athletes to be able to spend another night in their beds, be with their families if they have them, and really just decompress after that game four. So, fortunately, the GM and coach listened, and we flew to San Jose Friday night, got there. We played Saturday, and I think that was a game that, if I'm remembering correctly, we won 5-0, 5-1, and was the game that we ended up I think clinching the series that game, if I'm remembering correctly. But regardless of that, I think that utilizing the technologies that we have access to and really trying to show that that information was going to impact our athletes is kind of, I guess, what helped solidify the decision-making process to stay. And fortunately, it worked out for me, and I gained some points with the coach and the GM and some trust there. So I think that obviously, more importantly for the team, it worked out well. But for me, it solidified some of the trust that I have from our coaching staff.
I mean, we all know, and we're seeing all this new research coming out on sleep and recovery and the importance of, getting into a deeper sleep and letting the body kind of rest and heal. But we still see, teams not taking full advantage of that research. And it's good to see that, when you do attempt to put everything into place and to kind of follow what it shows and what it says, you see a positive outcome and you're like, ah, this is nice. Like, it's almost like
Right.
the Lego bricks that fit like very, easily in place. It's like, ah, it's perfect. It's just what it was meant to be.
Yeah, I think it's never a perfect science working in team sport. But I think when you have an opportunity to impact the group with, a decision-making process, I think you can really embrace that opportunity and show how technology can really impact some of those choices. And it's never going to be a perfect science. I don't think it's ever going to answer every question we have for making our athletes perform well, but it can certainly help with finding better ways to decide on what you think is going to work best. And so I think that was an opportunity where it actually played out in a positive way for us.
So let's run through, what does a day in the life of an NHL strength coach look like? Game day. It's 7 o'clock. What are you doing?
Yeah. Okay. So NHL strength coach, normal game day. So we're at home, I'm assuming. So I would say I get to the rink probably about 6:30 a.m. What I do first really is I get the gym set up, open everything up, and my first thing really is I get the shakes, the pregame shakes and pregame supplements all squared away for the athletes so that I can focus on the players when they're in the gym and just anything that's going on with injured athletes or some of the guys going through rehabilitation. So my first task is really getting those shakes and supplements ready. Once I get that done, we have a few guys that trickle in early. Jay Bouwmeester's a guy that I have a coffee with. We sit and chat for about an hour every morning. He comes in early after dropping off the kids at school. We don't really talk about hockey. It's more just hot stoving over life, and we have a lot of things in common, outside of hockey. So we just talk, and usually my, at that hour spent talking with Bo. And then once the boys roll in, it's going through warm-ups, going through, some of the guys do a lot of their lifting on game days, and so we'll go through lifts with certain guys. And then once those guys go into meetings start around 9:45. My return to play guys are in the gym, and that's when I'm working with those guys. Typically, the morning skate starts at 10:30. Most of the time, it's a full team skate. Once in a while, it's an optional. But when the boys are out during the morning skate, I'm finishing up with the return to play athletes, and then guys come in after they're doing a cool down. Some guys are doing some functional range work. Some guys are doing Aldoa. Some guys are, again, are finishing up with their lifts. And then the players in hockey that aren't going to be dressing that night and playing in the game are called healthy scratches. They'll typically come in after that morning skate. They'll usually be in the gym around 11:30, 11:45. And we'll do a lift or we'll do some metabolic work to offset some of the things that they aren't getting from the game that night. And then once they're done and showered and out of the rink, I try to head home, see the kids, at least one of, you know, my son who's not in, if he's not in school, and see my wife, spend a couple hours at home, take the dog out on a walk. By 3:30, I'm back at the rink. Supplements, shakes are in the stalls. Getting Compex is ready, getting all the warm-up equipment ready. We do a lot of work with essential oils, so I'm getting some of those things ready for the individual guys that use those. And then really, once the boys show up around 4:30, it's kind of like on the clock, right? I have certain guys at certain times on the clock. Guys play two-touch soccer in the gym. Sometimes I have to dominate them at two-touch. and then... you know, as soon as they're in their meetings at 5:30, it's really kind of go time and everyone's doing their specific warm-ups. And we're doing some force plate work with guys and modifying warm-ups if needed. And so it's really kind of once they show up around 4 o'clock, 4:30, it's really go time. You're really kind of on the clock. And then once the game hits, it's, you know, that's when things kind of calm down and you're watching the game. You know, I spent some time with the massage therapist talking about treatments and, you know, watching the game. Obviously, we want, one of the things that's important for me is to understand the situational aspects to the game and you know, our coach's perspective on performance. And so I'm really, you know, pretty dialed into what's going on during the game. And that way, if there's questions that pop up about performance, you know, we can talk about that with a little bit more certainty. And so that's kind of a typical game day. Once the game ends, it's usually around the office, man. Yeah, hockey traditionally is a sport where they've done post-game lifts and try to gain some training effect after games. I've shifted that mindset with the athletes here to really try to prioritize recovery and regeneration. I really hadn't found that we were getting a lot of training effect post-game, you know, for multiple reasons. You know, if we had lost, some of the guys weren't interested in training, you know, the effort wasn't there, and it just really dragged the night on for them. So I shifted that mindset about three seasons ago to really prioritize recovery and regen and nutrition after games. So we've eliminated post-game lifts. Guys do come in and they're doing mobility and cool downs, and you know, those are all things that we, you know, I love, but the lifting is really reserved for practice days and mornings of game days. So once the guys are done, we're out of there. I'm usually home by 11:15. And, you know, again, depending on what the schedule is, we might be back at it the next day for a game, or it could be a practice day. So that's a typical game day for me at home in St. Louis.
So you mentioned earlier about the using the force plates. You have a pretty in-depth knowledge of force plate technology and utilization. How'd you get that start? What got you going in that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'd say that, you know, I've been fortunate to have been exposed to force plates and other technologies throughout my career. I got my start probably, I guess it was, really, I point and the main tool there was force plates. And so, you know, that's where I got my exposure to working with them on a daily basis. I'd say,
Eric, where was that, real quick? You broke up when you said the name.
I first got my experiences working with force plates on a daily basis at a facility called Sparta Performance Science.
Gotcha.
Out in the Bay Area. And, a guy named Phil Wagner was the founder of it was there. And, it was a unique experience because during that window we had, a lot of athletes in their off seasons, particularly baseball, soccer and volleyball athletes. And so, you know, it was really about training those athletes and using the force plates to identify, specific training interventions. And, when there was no athletes, it was just Phil and I working on the force plates, training each other, coming up with exercises and seeing if they worked and trying to test each other to see if those force plate variables were changing. So it was a really, I guess, the experience was very, very in depth because I was doing force plates every day. When I moved on from there, again, I had opportunity to continue using force plates of various kinds. And yeah, I think it's been a really cool experience to see how the industry has changed, see how force plates have become popular. And the way I'm using them now is similar in some ways, but very different in other ways. And so it's been a really cool experience to see how technology's changing and becoming more efficient for coaches.
So what's your affiliation with Hawken Dynamics?
I'm a very happy user of Hawken Dynamics. They've been a company for me for the last 3 years that has been really, I guess their biggest strength is catering to the user and really making their software as efficient as it can be for coaches that are working in settings similar to mine, and really making the ease of use, I guess, as efficient as possible for it to fit into the training environment. I think that's what their main goal is to really provide coaches the opportunity to utilize technology in the training environment and really have the opportunity to look at the data in a way that allows them to make some quick decision making on what they're going to be doing with their athletes. So I'm a very happy user, and I support them in the same way that they support me. So they've been awesome for us and a really influential partner in how I'm operating.
Now, I'm gonna try to get this podcast edited and out ASAP. But April 4th initially, or April 5th and 6th, was it? You guys were going to have a course that you were going to be speaking at on force plate utilization.
Yeah. So it's April 5th, and it was April 5th and 6th. Obviously, with COVID-19, that in the travel restrictions and the self-quarantining, that that's obviously been shifted into a digital format. So the course is still open, and it's going to be all online. And there's some really, really smart people that are going to be talking, smarter than me. So I'm looking forward to learning from them. But it's going to be a really cool opportunity to share experiences with others. The people that are talking all have unique experiences. Jason Lake's a brilliant practitioner from the UK, professor in biomechanics, and really kind of for me, he's the gold standard for force plate interpretation. And so really looking forward to Jason talking. Daniel Hicker, who's a good friend of mine, really underrated practitioner. He's a high-level operator with the San Jose Earthquakes. He's the head of sports performance there, with the Major League Soccer team. Awesome point of view and how he trains athletes and how he uses data to drive his decision making. And then Lauren Green, who's at the University or UC San Diego, formerly with the Brooklyn Nets. Very excited to hear his perspective, especially with working with athletes that jump for a living. So it's going to be an awesome. I think it's going to be an awesome experience, and I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of it.
So I think as more populations and practitioners and coaches are learning about force plates and their uses and what the data means and what how we interpret it and create platforms and plans around it, what do you think is going to be kind of the biggest shift in making it more accessible to everyone else? I know they're getting cheaper. I know they're getting more readily available, and we're understanding more. What do you think is going to be kind of that real big push for it? And then on top of that, like you said, with the jump athletes, a lot of people are thinking that this is something where it's a force plate. You're doing a lot of jumping related stuff. That it's strictly for those sports or those movements. But man, there's so much you can get for pretty much any sport based off of what that information is telling you.
Yeah, I think that it's certainly, I wouldn't say it's the only thing to utilize. when you're looking at, you know, creating programs for athletes, it's definitely been a huge component to how I operate. Where I see force plates becoming, I don't know if you want to use the word mainstream or not, but where I see force plates really impacting sport from the high school level through the professional level is really in the accessibility of the software and the data that you can utilize in an effective manner from those softwares. And I think that with Hawken Dynamics, for example, their plates are completely wireless. So for me, I can travel with them. I don't need to have them plugged into a wall, and the information is directly sent to the cloud when testing via Bluetooth on our tablet. So it makes testing in any environment super easy. I think that's, again, where you're going to see high schools, colleges, and professional teams really embracing force plates in the future is through that wireless and that that cloud-based software technology. So I think it's going to be a game changer. And the more people that can share their experiences and how they use force plates, I think the better it's going to be for the industry in general and for coaches and practitioners at all levels.
So when you're having somebody jump, you're testing them, what are you looking for? Like, what's some of the pertinent data that helps guide how you train them? If they get a heavy day, if they get a light day, understanding fatigue, understanding how they're creating force and pressure, just kind of all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I think in general, I mean, what we're looking for is insights into the strategy that our athletes are choosing to create movement and force, and really trying to understand how those athletes are dissipating forces, how they're creating forces, what's the duration of force that these athletes are able to produce, and really trying to understand the strategies that they're using to accomplish that. So what I look for are, broken down phases of a force time tracing. And within those different phases, I'm looking at the relationship between those variables, and I'm trying to understand where we can direct our training interventions to be more efficient in our program for our athletes. So, if we're looking for an athlete to be quicker or faster, we can see that with our eye. We can time that with timing gates or with radar. We can see that an athlete's slow or fast, and we can compare. But really, for us, it's about breaking down and understanding where we need to direct our intervention to make that athlete faster or quicker, and really understanding how that strategy that they're using to create movement is what we can use to direct our program. So that's kind of a simplified explanation. Again, when I look at those relationships between the variables and the force time tracing, I call them, I use the term asymmetry, not necessarily left and right. We do look at the left and right asymmetry for our athletes. I think it's important to understand that, in a sport like hockey, a sport like baseball, for example, there's a lot of inherent asymmetries due to the sport. And, a lot of those asymmetries are what make these athletes special and elite. And so it's not necessarily that we want to remove those asymmetries, but it's about understanding what's healthy and what bandwidth should we be working in with these guys to keep that asymmetry in a level that elicits, high level performances, but also keeps them healthy. So we do look at those asymmetries, but more importantly, I look at the asymmetries between the different phases within the jump and what those relationships are. So, for example, there's variables in the unweighting phase, the braking phase. There's a phase that I call a switch phase, which is that amortization phase between the braking and propulsive phase, and then that propulsive phase of force production. So I'm looking at all the variables within that tracing, and then what the asymmetry is like between those variables that I feel are important. So it's a pretty helpful tool, I guess, for us. I'm simplifying our program. From what I'm saying, it can make things more complicated, but it's really simplified what we were doing. And then for return to play, it's been a great tool for us to objectively identify how our athletes are advancing through the phases. And, we call it a meritocracy, and the athletes advanced through phases. You know, obviously early on, it's when the pathologies are clearing and medically cleared to do certain things. But then once they get into a mid to end stage return to play, it's really about how they're eliciting some of those force variables. And so it's been a huge addition to what we're doing. And it certainly, I feel, has been a big impact to the success of our athletes.
So with that, with using those kind of parameters in hockey, what would you do maybe differently, or what would you think to look at differently for baseball athletes, pitchers, hitters, whatever?
Yeah, I think, you know, like the way I look at qualities in training athletes in general, I mean, there's three things that I'm looking for. There's one, you know, I've recently just kind of like termed it situational, which is game related information. You know, and that's a lot of times coming from what the coaches see. I think in hockey, you can say, like, you know, he'll talk about a guy not being strong on the boards and not winning board battles and, you know, not winning puck battles. You know, I think in baseball, it could be things like they're not reading the play. You know, there's going to be a lot of situational components to what the coaches are seeing and how performance is occurring with those athletes. So they're, you know, there's that section of it. The next section, I really, you know, look at the mechanical aspect, and that's where some of the force plate information comes into play. And then my third component would be kind of that physiological / metabolic component of performance. So, you know, when I'm looking at training our athletes, I'm trying to figure out, you know, from those three qualities, you know, what's happening to the performance and kind of where's the bottleneck for why those performances, you know, may not be as adequate as they should be. So, looking at it from a, you know, a perspective of my position, I'm kind of a conduit for, you know, what the coaches are looking at, and then really trying to use science and the experiences that I have to figure out the best solution for making this athlete better. So I guess, you know, when we come down to breaking it into intervention, it's about understanding the physics behind why we're seeing what we're seeing. Generally speaking, I think, you know, hockey, baseball, they're, you know, there's a big physics component to it, and there's a big personal component to it, and understanding how to communicate to the individual. I think that's primary. And you really have to have that ability to communicate and not only gain the athlete's trust, but really communicate why we're trying to improve these aspects of their game. And then from there, it's about understanding the physics and how the physics are applying to what they're actually doing, and really finding the solution to what the problem is. So it's, I don't know if there's a, you know, a way to say specifically in baseball or hockey, you know, that there's the right answer or not, but I think there's certainly a blend of those three things. And, you know, I think it's important to understand how you take the subjective situational feedback from a coach or a manager and try to figure out why what they're seeing is happening, and then using some of the information that you can objectively collect from the athletes and then coming up with an intervention for that person.
Yeah. Like the way I look at it is with like a pitcher, because that's, you know, where I work a lot more with pitchers. If I see someone over recruiting, you know, their center of mass or center of pressure a little bit differently, too much, you know, anterior chain over posterior chain, too much of the outside of the foot over the inside of the foot, it's going to completely change how they kind of build and generate force, and also how they use that force, which is going to kind of unlock or reveal some potential compensations up the entire kinetic chain that you typically see with, you know, if someone is quad dominant, if someone's not using their glutes, if they're not, you know, if they, when they jump, they, you know, hyperextend their back too much. And there's other things that kind of break down throughout the chain that you can get, you know, from a simple, you know, counter movement jump, or even like a lateral bound or whatever. You don't even necessarily need to put that force plate into the mound. You're going to get an idea on how their brain wants to generate that force.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of that information that you're able to collect, you can utilize in several ways. And I think one of the things that we've tried to do is to try to profile for elite performers within each position and utilize game-related statistics and blending those statistics with what we're seeing on the force plate in those elite performers and really trying to identify how we can keep those elite performers elite and maybe help some of the athletes in those positions that maybe aren't performing as well game in some of the game-related statistics and improve their efficiency so that you know, they can meet some of those standards that I think our management and our coaching staff feel are important. So pitching, I think, is a really similar, I guess, position to, you know, with our goalies. It's really key that their movement quality is managed well. And if we see certain things that are happening in the game-related statistics with these athletes, a lot of it starts with the mechanical interactions with the surface, you know, with the mound or with the ice. And, you know, for us as practitioners, if we can identify some of these breakdowns, as you said, in the kinetic chain, we can delay or remove some of these components that might be impacting their production, either on, you know, as a pitcher or as a goalie. So I think that, you know, those are perfect examples of how the sports kind of overlap each other.
Let's talk about that a little more on the kind of the crossover of movements and motions. Say, you know, with a hitter or pitcher, you know, hitting a baseball, throwing a baseball to hitting a slap shot. How much do you see movement crossover? Like, I know you've heard of examples of, you know, elite athletes that can, you know, hit a home run and also hit a slap shot 100 miles an hour. And then you've seen some that, you know, are first round draft picks in hockey that can't hit a baseball to save their life. Like, how much of the correlation of movements do you think carries over?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of carryover in terms of just the general, athleticism of the individual. You know, certainly I think when you look at the visuomotor aspects of striking a baseball versus striking a hockey puck, I mean, there's certainly timing involved there. There's lots of information that can be utilized to understand how you can impact that. I think from a physics perspective, you know, it's really about, you know, obviously starting from the ground up. I think even in hockey, even though you're on skates and on ice, I always talk about interacting with that surface. And that's going to be, you know, the goal of our athletes is to really understand how those interactions are occurring. And from that ground up, are they making the proper you know, patterns occur through the kinetic chain. And, you know, I think TPI does a great job with one of their courses on talking about golf swings, but it really, for me, it carries over to baseball and hockey very well, because you really want to have the proper breakdown and how those, either the swing or the initiation of a slap shot occur. And if it's done out of sequence, you're going to have, you know, a product that's subpar. So I think there's a lot of carryover. There's some differences in technique for sure. I mean, I can't say a baseball swing and hitting a slap shot are going to be, you know, the same skill set, but there's definitely a lot of similarities in terms of the physics for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So earlier you mentioned part of your daily routine, doing a little bit of like essential oil stuff. I know we've talked on some of how you guys, or what your thoughts and ideas are on that, just, you know, in our personal conversations, but how do you see yourself using like multisensory integration just to up and down regulate the central nervous system?
Well, I think it's a huge opportunity for our athletes to get better. And I think it's something that's, you know, I'm really trying to improve on as a practitioner and explore and find ways to utilize with our athletes. You know, from utilizing scent, I can tell you that I've been doing a lot of research on implementing scent with our players, primarily for relaxation. But we also have some athletes that are utilizing that from I guess an excitation point of view. And so some of the athletes are using peppermint, wintergreen for pregame and during game and utilizing those to excite, I guess, to upregulate the nervous system and maintain a level of focus, open up the airway and allow them to utilize oxygen more appropriately. And I think those are, there is some science behind it. I think there's a lot more that's being done to explore how it's impacting people in general. But one of the things that I've wanted to do with our athletes is figure out as many possible ways to give them choices and provide them with things to choose, based on what they feel is going to impact them the most, rather than me limiting their options and saying, this is the only thing that I think is going to work. I really have been trying to give them more freedom of choice. And I think that's been a big impact, not only on my relationship with the athletes, but on their performance as well. So scent has been a big thing. Diffusing essential oils has been shown to, especially using lavender and vanilla, has been shown to create a sensation of relaxation and calming. And, with our travel schedule and our game schedule, much like baseball, we're done with games at 11 o'clock and we might be flying directly after. And, guys aren't sleeping until 3 or 4 in the morning. And if they've been utilizing, caffeine or any sort of stimulants, that's even, potentially still in their system by the time they go to bed. So really trying to figure out those types of opportunities to get them to sleep and relax more effectively.
I want to say it was a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, Sean Doolittle, the reliever for the Nationals, said that he had put, I want to say it was lavender oil in his glove that he would smell as he's kind of, come and set, just to kind of help relax him during the World Series as the nerves and everything are sparking and going nuts. Did you see that article?
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, because I had just been talking about that on Twitter probably a week or two before, and then I saw that and I was like, yes, that's awesome.
See, I'm not crazy.
Right. Yeah, no, it was cool. I saw that, and some of the boys saw it, and they were like, "Oh, E, I guess you're right." So it was cool.
Do you use any other sensory deprivation or anything else to kind of trick the nervous system or to train the other senses to kind of become a more all around athlete as they're training?
I guess I wouldn't say while we're training. We do a lot with sensory deprivation tanks. I think our athletes have embraced that, very well. I think there's a place here called Float STL. You probably have heard of it, but a lot of our athletes utilize those separate sensory deprivation tanks for recovery. One of the things that we're looking at with some of our athletes, a lot of times during games and pregame, we think of athletes needing to upregulate the nervous system and really ramp up and kind of get excited. We have a couple of guys that are kind of on the other end of the spectrum where they're too excited and it takes them, maybe a full period to calm down and get to the peak of that, that readiness curve. And so what we're utilizing, some with our force plates, but more so with, getting them to be at the right level of readiness, is we're using thermotherapy and utilizing sauna therapy and heat therapy to downregulate their nervous system just enough so that, they're not overexcited. And then once that game starts, they're actually starting on time and not taking, a whole period to calm down. So, it's a unique perspective, but we've been doing a lot with thermotherapy to try to really downregulate with a couple of our athletes. And some of our data from our force plate has been helpful to show that, their readiness is a little bit overdone. So it's been a cool opportunity. But I wouldn't say that we're utilizing those things on regular training days, more so for game day performances.
So Eric, you have a proficiency in force plate technology and other kind of recovery technologies and all kinds of different modalities for training. What do you think is on the horizon? What's the next thing to really kind of shift the industry or to shift performance in sport?
I think there's two things. One's pressure mapping. I think pressure mapping often gets confused with force analysis. The data is similar in the charting of the, you know, if you're using that during a jump, it might look similar. But the main difference between force plates and pressure mapping is that one of them gives you objective kinetic measurements, and one of them gives you much more descriptive application of ground reaction forces. So I think pressure mapping is going to be more prevalent in the coming year. Force plate analysis and pressure mapping is going to be more common. I think understanding the kinetics of force application, but more so, you know, how the foot is interacting with the ground during that movement is going to be, I think, where people really get granular with understanding injury patterns. And then I think the next piece of technology and something that I've been exploring a lot with Victor is, you know, really visuomotor and vestibular control and performances. You know, from two perspectives. One, from a performance perspective, I think in, you know, certainly in hockey and baseball and sports that require timing, you know, it's a huge component. And then, you know, for me, in sports like hockey, football, and you know, even in soccer, you're seeing a lot of concussion. And I think, you know, returning an athlete to play from concussion has been, you know, for the most part, very subjective and gray. And I think utilizing some of the technology that you can get now with companies like iSync, you're going to be able to return athletes to play much more objectively post-concussion you know, have better baselines for athletes that have experienced concussion or concussion-like symptoms. So I think those are the pieces of technology that I think in the next 2 to 3 years are going to be huge.
I'm glad you brought that up about the concussions, just because that is, most people, when they think of concussions, they think football, and it's so prevalent in hockey. It's so prevalent. And you're right, there hasn't been a good way to identify and objectify when someone has concussion or concussion, post-concussion type symptoms. You know, should they be on the ice? Should they take 7 days off? That's important, especially now that we're understanding more about head trauma and getting a little bit more research into things like CTE and these athletes' lives after their sport. Like it's pretty important.
Yeah, I think it's certainly an area where I think in team sport particularly, it's been a very difficult scenario to objectively understand. And I think having technology like, you know, again, iSync is the tech that I'm using now, but having access to something like that is really great because it incorporates some of the subjective tests, SCAT-5 and some of the other concussion tests that are being done into the ability, you know, tying that in with the ability to understand the more advanced stages of rehabilitation that an athlete is utilizing during oculomotor and oculovestibular functioning. So it's really a cool opportunity to be more objective and provide better care to our athletes. So I think it's a great technology, and I think as it becomes more prevalent, it's going to be something that people really try to get their hands on and utilize in the team setting.
So I had a request to ask you a question, actually.
Okay.
That was the what are your ideologies about periodization, both in season and in the off season?
Cool. So I guess in season, I will say this. My philosophy changes significantly when we get in season. You know, I think really being flexible with our athletes has been more successful for me in the past 2 years than regimenting on specific movements that I think that they need to work on to sustain their strong areas in their performances and improve their weak areas. What happens there, because our schedules are very dense in terms of games and travel, having the ability to stick to a strict schedule of training, it does have 4 games in 6 nights to 2 games in 7 days. And it's really dependent on what our schedule's like. And sometimes we're on the road during those 2 games in 7 days, and we don't have access to facilities. And it's very challenging to stick to all the off-season. So I've been following more randomization model. I found that being flexible to athletes and training them in multiple ways has actually been better, because if we don't have access to equipment like we do at home when we're on the road, we can still train because we've done those movements before. We've done some movements, even nutritional now, where everyone's in self-quarantine, managed at home with minimal equipment. There's been programs that have been able to do because we've been doing some of those things during the season. So I would say that it's a very randomized periodization scheme with a lot of flexibility and utilization of multiple modalities of training. With that said, in the off season, I follow a very structured program. I guess the best name for it, again, is called, we call it a meritocracy program. We do follow set rep and loading schemes for strength, hypertrophy, power. But those athletes advance through the phases of that off-season program based on how they're producing variables on the force plate and through their loading schemes and the velocities of some of their movements. And so we have a pretty strict clearing phase or a clearing test in each phase, and the athlete, only advance based on those abilities. We eliminated the temporal form of periodization about 5 years ago when I was in Vancouver, because we were seeing that athletes were if it was June 1st and they moved into, say phase 2, some of the athletes were ready 2 weeks earlier, and some of the athletes, weren't ready, but they were still in phase 2. And so we shifted that model into, again, where we're at now with this meritocracy model and utilizing, velocity-based metrics, loading metrics, and then the force plate to identify whether this athlete has actually made some changes that are appropriate for them to advance. And so it's been a, it's a very, I guess, a very scientific, objectively driven program, but very different than our in-season plan. And that's just, that's circumstantial. And that's, it's, I found that's, we've had to have kind of, I guess if you want to call them periodization models or ideologies, but very different. And it's really based off of the ability to train and really find the right way to train based around their schedule.
So you mentioned being on the road, having challenges of finding equipment, finding facilities, whatever you need to do to get the training in. Would you say that's your biggest challenge day to day, or is there more pressing issues that you have to deal with?
I would say, while we're traveling and we're on the road, I think access to equipment is probably a big challenge. I also think just the schedule. When we're on the road, we're typically pretty condensed with games, and we're not, unlike baseball, we're not often in the city for more than one night. And so, we might be in the city, arrive at 5 o'clock p.m., get to the hotel, play the next day, and then we're out that night to the next city. And a lot of times it's a back to back. So it's really, I think it's 50-50 on access to equipment, and then really what the schedule dictates and allows. So I think it's a combination. But if we do have time at the rink and we are practicing, again, having some of the flexibility in our in how we're training athletes now and utilizing body weight and mobility for improvement, I think that's been a big addition to our program, where you're utilizing a lot of functional range techniques. A lot of our athletes embrace LDOAs, so we're doing a lot more with trying to improve performance through other means than just lifting weights and jumping and you know, trying to get what we call stronger. You know, I think there's a lot of benefit to those other modalities, and those are things that I think we're able to do more effectively on the road than you know, training with weights and external load all the time.
So you mentioned a lot of like techniques and tools and technology. What would you say is your most valuable tool in your toolbox?
I'd say communication for sure. I don't know that that's considered a tool or not, but I think it's a skill set that I've had to really focus on developing over the last 10 or 12 years in working in team sport. I feel one of my biggest weaknesses, you know, over you know the last 10 or 12 years is really kind of let you know been letting go of what I. You know, what I feel is the best way to get better, and really trying to, you know, be more humble and find ways to learn about how others are doing things and figure out what makes other people successful. And I think doing that has really been where I think I've seen myself grow the most. And utilizing communication is, I think, has been the biggest tool for that because. No matter what we're doing, whether it's Eldoa utilizing scent like lavender, telling a guy that, you know, he'd been in NHL for 10 years to start using lavender. Like those are things that, you know, aren't th those things aren't going to happen overnight. And if you can communicate those things to them well enough that they understand the benefits, you're going to get some impact from the tool that you're picking. And so I think communication's certainly been the biggest tool for me and creating a successful environment for our athletes.
That's a strong answer. That was a good one.
Thanks.
So here's a question I like to ask anytime I interview someone, and that's what's a thought or idea that you have that no one else believes is true? Like something that you strongly feel is one way when the overall majority disagrees.
Question. I think. And I don't know if I would say that there's a lot of people that are going to disagree with this. But I do think that there is the ability to, I guess there is the ability to predict emerging patterns for injury in athletes. And if you have a wide enough database, if you have the right tools and technology and the opportunity to utilize those tools regularly, I do think there's the ability to harness those data points and statistics to identify, again, potential emerging patterns for injury with athletes. And having the access to the injury database that we have with our athletes, we can go back and look at what was going on with those athletes through objective monitoring of those individuals during those periods of injury and see what was going on. And then again, using statistics, we can identify these emerging patterns. I think there's a lot of people out there that I think that's a bit, you know, available, but I think there's probably more people that would disagree with me on the potential for, I don't know if you want to use prediction or not, but you know, for identifying those emerging patterns.
There are a ton of biomechanists and practitioners that would call BS on that, but I tend to agree with you.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the way I look at it, you know, I'm in a situation where we're working and, you know, with guys on a daily basis. You know, the goal of our organization is to win and to win now. And I have to make quick snap decisions on what I feel is the best, decision to impact that goal of the organization and the individual need of the athlete. And if I can use data to make better decisions, there's probably a ton of people that are going to disagree on this, but I think that having technology and the ability to utilize smarter people than me to help identify these trends, you can really make choices in your programming and other interventions to reduce some of these patterns from happening. And again, I think that all comes back to load management what you're doing with the athletes from a nutritional standpoint, how you utilize biomarker analysis to improve supplementation and reduce inflammation factors, and how we can improve sleep and rest and recovery. All of those things are holistically combined to affect these emerging patterns, and I do think there's the ability to do that.
Yeah, I know that you you're the head strength coach for the Stanley Cup defending champs, but I have a really strong feeling that you're going to have a future in baseball. I mean, I know so many teams, really well ran teams, that would use you would see you as a very valuable asset. So I mean, I know hockey's been good to you, but I think that there's definitely a future in baseball, with all the assets that you bring and your ability to understand the nuances of force plate data and technology. I mean, that's like the one thing in baseball that baseball hasn't really grasped yet. We're taking off into pitch tracking and technology to identify spin, and we're starting to get more into force plates, but motion capture has kind of been a big thing recently. But I do think that I think that in baseball, that the force plate technology and the pressure mapping is starting to get there. It's about to take off, but it's not there yet. So like you would you step into baseball and it just kind of changes the landscape. That's just me
Yeah,
talking.
I think that, yeah, no, I mean, I think, baseball and like I said, we talked about this over coffee many times. I think there's a ton of crossover between baseball and hockey. And I think, from a physics perspective, like we talked about, a mental perspective of reading the game and all of those things that occur in both sports, I think there's a lot of carryover. I think probably, what I've realized even more, is that the culture of baseball players and hockey players is there's a lot of similarities between the two. And, my experience working with baseball has all been in the private sector with, players from different teams. And so, not speaking, on any one team and how they operate, but just how the players are and how they embrace training and, the similarities with the difficulty in season travel and the load that they're under for games. There's a lot of carryover, and I think baseball has certainly been a big driver for how a lot of people are operating with the use of technology. And like you said, understanding more about the physics of the sport with spin rates, exit velocities and such. And I think those are all things that are exciting for sport in general. But like I said, last time we chatted, there's a lot of carryover, and baseball is an exciting sport for guys like me because we can learn a lot from baseball and really utilize it to make athletes better in lots of different ways.
So we've covered a ton. What resources would you recommend to the listeners, whether they're in the strength and conditioning field, coaching field, into hockey, into baseball? What's something that they should read, learn, go to seminars? What's something that really sticks out to you that you think is kind of the most valuable area to start trying to learn from?
Well, I guess I online I think there's Simply Faster has been I guess a powerhouse in the content for strength and conditioning, sports science. I think they've been awesome at putting out information for people on all aspects of performance and just in general. Altus, again, they've done a great job with taking really, I guess, their information is put together in a foundations course now that's been super dialed in with experts in each category that they talk about. From a perspective that I'm coming from, I really find the books by Atul Gawande really impactful. He's the author of Checklist Manifesto, Better, Complications, and books like that. He's a doctor, a surgeon, and he's an author that, and I think those books really provide a lot of perspective on just how you work with people and health and the mortality that we're experiencing, especially in, with COVID-19 and things like that. And the other books I would recommend are the books by Jocko Willink. I think having communication skills and leadership skills, all of those things, and the experiences that he had, leading SEAL teams and working with people in the business industry, I think those are all great learning experiences that we can take and embrace in one way or another at working with athletes and clients and team sports.
Those are all really awesome answers. I mean, I can personally vouch for every one of those. Gwande is the only one I haven't really dug into as much, and that is something that would be on my list for sure. Dan Papp and Stuart McMillan over at Altus and the rest of that crew, they're top notch. They're so good.
Right. Yeah, I think it's just the people that Altus has, obviously working there. Darrell Etto is a great friend and mentor of mine. He's working with Altus. There's some fantastic high-level operators there. Simply Faster, I think they access some of the best practitioners in the industry to write articles for them and provide content. And again, with Gawande and Willink, I think those are guys that are the best in the business at what they do. And so I'm always trying to learn from people that are excellent at what they do, and it doesn't matter the industry. So I think those are all great resources.
So Eric, we're starting to wrap up. We're past the hour mark. Anything you want to get off your chest? Anything you want to promote or lasting words?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think it's just I'm always eager to learn from others, and hopefully people find that there's a little bit of value in what we chatted about today. And I really am an open book when it comes to what we're doing. And if there's any time that people want to reach out or talk shop, that's really what excites me is getting to talk to other people about what they're doing. So just like you and I do all the time with when we grab coffee, I think that's really kind of what excites me. So, I guess if there's anybody that is willing to talk shop, I'm an open book and I'm ready to go
And how do
once
people?
the self quarantine's over.
Yeah, exactly. You can pour your own coffee or make your own coffee at home and then get on the phone.
Right.
How do people get a hold of you?
Probably I'm most accessible on Twitter at Eric Renahan. And then I get a lot of emails. My email is eric.renahan@gmail.com. Probably those are the two easiest ways to get a hold of me. I think I tweet too much these days, but
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of cool information out there. But yeah, I think those are probably the two easiest ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. So real quick, what's the insider word on the NHL hockey season?
Dude, I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to say. There's been talk about a playoff structure later in the summer. I think there's obviously way too much up in the air with what's going on in the world right now. I do think the NHL wants to present the Stanley Cup at some point this year, but I don't think they want to risk the community, the athletes, the staff, the coaches. That are in the NHL, to do so. So I think they're doing things the right way. There's a lot of smart people that are making those decisions, but I don't know. It's gonna be interesting. Whatever they decide is gonna be the right thing, and I think it's gonna work out for everybody. But I certainly think that the health and well-being of the community is priority number one right now. So I think it's kind of a wait and see thing.
It's crazy. Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll get through it. Just takes time.
Yep.
So, all right, Eric Renahan, good chatting with you, man. It was real nice talking with
Awesome. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
you. Yeah, take care. Stay safe.
You too. Bye, Tyler.
So, there you have it with Eric Renahan. I'm lucky to call him a friend. He's incredibly intelligent, very intuitive. If you want to learn more from Eric or more about force plate technology, go check out the resource he's helping out with through Hawken Dynamics. They have an online course that I believe is available now. you know, like I've mentioned previously, this is going to be something that everyone needs to be able to understand. This is about to be a widely known and used resource. So it's important to know how to use it now, and they're ahead of the game over there. So Eric would be definitely someone that I would point people to go learn from. Are you upset that you weren't able to make it to the 2020 World Pitching Congress? Well, now you don't have to be, because you can watch it from the comfort of your own home. Check out the Gestalt Performance website to purchase the World Pitching Congress digital experience. If you're an athletic trainer, chiropractor, physical therapist, strength coach, or pitching coach, this is your way to sharpen your skills and stay on top of the game.